Welcome to the Yogic Studies Podcast. I'm your host, Seth Powell. This podcast features in-depth explorations into the traditions of yoga, Sanskrit, Indian philosophy, and South Asian religions. Through candid conversations with scholars and practitioners, we will immerse in the latest and most cutting-edge research on all things yoga. Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 9 of the Yogic Studies Podcast. In today's episode, we'll be speaking with Dr. Jason Birch from SOAS, University of London. Jason and I had a wide-ranging conversation on all things yoga, from the Rishikesh yoga scene in the early 2000s, manuscript hunting in India, the history of asana, and so much more. Jason's work, along with that of Dr. James Mallinson, who I interviewed in a previous episode, has been particularly influential on my own academic trajectory. And so it was a special opportunity to get to sit down with him for this slightly more formal chat and to learn more about Jason's story. Apologies in advance that this episode is slightly longer than usual, but once Jason and I get going about medieval yoga, it's pretty hard to stop. Dr. Jason Birch is a postdoctoral research fellow at SOAS, University of London. After completing a first-class honors degree in Sanskrit and Hindi at the University of Sydney under Dr. Peter Oldmeadow, Jason was awarded a Clarendon Scholarship to undertake a DPhil in Oriental Studies at the University of Oxford under the supervision of Professor Alexis Sanderson. His dissertation, which was submitted in 2013, focused on the earliest known Raja Yoga text called the Amanuska, and included a critical edition and annotated translation of this Sanskrit work, along with a monographic introduction. Jason is currently a postdoctoral research fellow at SOAS, working on the Hatha Yoga Project, a five-year ERC-funded project, which is now in the final year of completion. His particular area of research for the project is the history of physical yoga on the eve of colonialism. Jason is currently editing and translating 6 principal texts on Hatha and Raja Yoga, which will soon be available for publication. He also collaborates with Jacqueline Hargreaves on The Luminescent, an online hub for sharing yoga research. So without further ado, I hope you enjoy this wide-ranging conversation with Dr. Jason Birch. All right, I'm here with Jason Birch. Jason, welcome to the Yogic Studies Podcast. It's an absolute pleasure to have you here.
Well, thanks for the invitation.
Yeah. How are you doing? How's your quarantine time? I know this is a very strange time for everyone, but how are things going for you? And where are you right now?
We're living at our in North Oxfordshire in a barn that we rented at the beginning of the year, and we're very fortunate to be here because we have access to country walks, and we're a little bit isolated from the large towns that have experienced problems with the virus. So we've been in a good situation, and it's been a productive time. A lot of academic events have been cancelled over the summer, so it's enabled us to write. And just at the right time, because the project ends on the 30th of September, and we really should be focusing on finalizing the outputs. And I think if the lockdown hadn't occurred, we would not have made as much progress as we have in that regard. So for us, it's been beneficial in some ways.
Yeah, a sort of forced writer's retreat, perhaps.
Yes, and in hindsight, that's what we should have planned to do, whether there was a lockdown or not. I think we said last year that we should cancel any commitments and leave our calendars free for writing. But when you get invited to various events and conferences, it can be hard to say no. So that didn't happen until the lockdown occurred, and then those events were cancelled, and we ended up having a writer's retreat.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah, and you mentioned that you're nearing the end of this 5-year Hatha Yoga project. Publications and critical editions, deadlines are starting to appear. And I want to discuss all of that and your fantastic contributions to this project, and to get into your really pioneering research on Hatha and Raja Yoga, the history of asana, and so much more. But before we get into all of that, you know, one of the things I'm aiming to do on this podcast is to also learn a little bit about the stories and biographies of these yoga scholars, and to learn a little bit from you today, Jason, about, you know, how you came to do this work. How did you become a Sanskritist to working on this Hatha Yoga project? How did you get into yoga? And then how did that, you know, bring you into academia?
Well, it, now that I look back, it seemed to happen by chance in many respects. I was studying classics at Sydney University as an undergraduate student and enjoying it very much. I was mainly studying Latin and Roman history, and one of my Latin teachers would often talk about Sanskrit, particularly the cognate words that Sanskrit, Latin and Greek have similarities in their declensions and conjugations. And at the same time, I was reading a lot of English literature as well as philosophy. And I think it was probably the comments of my Latin teacher that piqued my interest in German philosophers and what they had to say about Sanskrit, particularly Schopenhauer, as well as Indian religions more broadly, Friedrich Nietzsche's comments about Buddhism were always very interesting, particularly in light of his critique of Christianity. And at the same time, I also remember the work of American transcendentalists like Emerson and Thoreau, their admiration for the Bhagavad Gita and so forth. And I think I was also, after studying classics for a year, starting to wonder how long I wanted to do it for. As you might know, with many of the great works of the classics, they've been fairly well studied. There's usually several editions, many, many books about them. And scholarship in that area is often required to assess past scholarship and then find a new angle to study. And and even though I hadn't discounted, I suppose, the possibility of pursuing it much further, I again, by chance, met the Sanskrit teacher at Sydney University. We hit it off. This was Dr. Peter Oldmeadow. His area of specialty was Mahayana Buddhism. And after talking and going to a few of Peter's classes, I realized that there was a world that I really didn't know much about, hadn't been exposed to beyond perhaps my own private reading, and that there was a lot to, of new material to learn and study. And so by the end of the first year of my BA, I transferred to Indian studies, from classics to Indian studies, majoring in Hindi and Sanskrit. And I think by the end of my BA, it was clear to me that there was a lot of research that one could do in the area. There were many texts hadn't been properly studied, and many manuscripts really hadn't been looked at for various works. I suppose at the same time, again, it was in the first year of my BA, my health was not so good. I'd been a chronic asthmatic since quite a young age. Throughout my teenage years, I'd been on medication for that. And then when I was in my early 20s, my asthma was basically worsening and the medication wasn't working. So friends advised various things. Swimming was one I remember, but I didn't like the cold water. And then someone suggested yoga. Mm-hmm. So again, this was in the first year of my study of Sanskrit. I tried a yoga class. I happened to find a very good teacher early on, which I think made a big difference. And after a year of doing yoga, I was pretty much free of medication for my asthma.
Mm, wow.
And more than that, I suppose my quality of life, particularly my energy levels, clarity of mind and so forth, were significantly improved. So it gave me great encouragement, I suppose, to pursue the practice for that reason. And then, of course, by the end of the year, I was starting to study Sanskrit, Indian history, and then, of course, took an interest in yoga texts. And it was probably by the end of my undergraduate degree that I realized that I could do further research in the history of yoga.
Wow, that's quite interesting. In what would come for you, I think, you know, knowing now, you know, the area of your research on physical hatha yoga and looking even at the confluence and parallels with hatha yoga and Ayurveda, classical Indian medicine, looking at some of these texts on medieval hatha yoga that prescribe particular asanas to eradicate particular diseases and ailments in the body. It's quite interesting that your beginnings of entering into a yoga practice and then leading you to study these yoga texts sort of began with your own asthma and wanting to remedy and treat that through a yoga practice.
Yes, I think I was also very lucky that the yoga scene in Sydney was very rich. As I said, I found a very good teacher. He was his name was Simon Borg-Olivier. He was an amazing inspiration. In the beginning, he had buckets and buckets of energy, and gave 100% of himself to his teaching and practice, and it was really a great inspiration to study with him. Sydney had a very large theosophical bookstore in the heart of the city that had all sorts of fascinating books on the shelves, including, of course, the old theosophical publications of Vivekananda, Annie Besant, mm-hmm. and so forth. And I remember looking through them when I started the practice of yoga and the study of Sanskrit, and they just seemed so different, so unusual. There was so much of what I read seemed difficult to penetrate, that the meaning and the reasons for the content mm-hmm. eluded me completely. And I remember reading the Hatha Pradipika at a fairly early stage and even trying to read parts of it in Sanskrit. And I really got so very little out of it. I sort of it was, again, almost impenetrable in many respects.
Mm.
And that sort of egged me on over the years to keep trying to answer the questions that these texts and the history and the publications have continually raised. And it's, I suppose, I've managed to answer some of those questions, but then, you know, we're talking about 2,000 years of history in a foreign culture. It's just so very rich in that respect. You really can never draw a line. There's always something new and something mysterious about it.
And was your experience at that time that the type of yoga that you were practicing and learning didn't match what you were reading in these texts and these publications, that they seemed to almost be talking about, you know, different things called yoga?
Yes, and even the differences between the modern styles. I mean, Simon was a physiotherapist who'd studied with Iyengar, but also had an interest in Ashtanga and Desikachar's teachings. So he knew a lot about, you might say, Krishnamacharya's yoga, as well as physiotherapy. He bring a lot of anatomy and physiology to the teachings. But I also went to a Shivananda yoga teacher in Sydney, Acharya Upendra Roy. And he was a fascinating character. He'd spend a lot of his classes just seated sort of on a dais, talking about his past experiences in India while sort of, you know, sort of telling the class, well, why don't you try Mayurasana? And while everyone's going red in the face, he'd be talking about, you know, his teacher at the Shivananda ashram and you know, really quite a an interesting character. And I suppose I never limited myself to one style of yoga. I always felt that the modern styles offered a slice or an aspect of yoga. Perhaps that was the advantage of studying some of its history at an early point. And then, you know, another, of course, another benefit of studying Sanskrit and Hindi academically was that, you know, I had access to a very rich environment at Sydney University at the Indian Studies Department. My teacher there, Peter Oldmeadow, he'd spent many years in India, was an expert in Buddhism and Sanskrit, and there were many visiting scholars as well as students. And I also remember that studying Hindi there required me to go to India for 1 month to do a summer school. I did it twice. And that summer school was held in Rishikesh, of all places.
Oh, wow.
So this was in 1999 and the year 2000. And I remember I lived in India between the summer school. So this, I think the summer school was held in January, and I spent most of the following months in India, and then did the following summer school in January. And I think I spent 9 months in Rishikesh that year, and going to the Shivananda ashram to the various yoga teachers who were teaching in Rishikesh. That was, again, another world of mystery in many respects and unanswered questions. Shivananda yoga has a particular focus. It has a strong emphasis on bhakti, particularly if you're going to the ashram, the morning and evening pujas, the kirtans and so forth. There are also other interesting yoga teachers passing through, a Hungarian lady I remember who was teaching Iyengar yoga at the Omkarananda ashram. Her classes were very enjoyable, and she was absolutely devoted to Mr. Iyengar and would spend many months in Pune studying with him. She was very inspiring. There was another senior Iyengar teacher in Rishikesh at that time, Rudradev. I went to some of his classes, and I remember his classes were absolutely full at that time, maybe 20 or 30 people crammed into his yoga studio. And, of course, those students were coming from all parts of the world. It was an international group. And just talking to other people about their experiences in yoga, why they were there, what they were wanting to learn. Some of them were teachers. Some of them had their own yoga studios. That too was a rich learning experience.
Yeah, that was probably a very interesting time in the yoga world to be doing yoga in Rishikesh in India. Kind of early 2000s, seems like that was right around when this kind of wave of kind of a global postural yoga boom was taking place.
Yes, and that was apparent in Rishikesh, I do remember, because there was a sort of an old world and a new world in Rishikesh that that was starting to clash in many respects. You had the Shivananda ashram and the teachers associated with that ashram doing what they'd been doing for 10 years or more. And then you had more foreigners coming in and more money sort of coming into, I suppose, Rishikesh for the practice of yoga. And then a festival, a sort of an international yoga festival, was started around that time. It was a very small affair in the beginning. There were other, you know, many other ashrams that were making a transition between a sort of an older audience and this new wave of people coming in for yoga. And
right.
Yeah, so that was interesting to see. I didn't at the time understand what was going on, but I do now see that. And of course, if one is aware of how Rishikesh has developed since that time, it's of course become much more commercial, and that international yoga festival is a huge event now, and it's probably one of many. And the ashrams back then that were just starting to become aware of the international interest in yoga and the benefits that might have for them are now well aware of that and have tried to accommodate it in all sorts of ways.
Yeah, and I think that time was also right before this kind of new wave of modern yoga studies and new scholarship that started to emerge that was turning to analyze and to study these processes and global yogas and looking at places like Rishikesh and that international yoga scene. I'm thinking of, I think it was Sarah Strauss, if I'm not mistaken. There was this book on transnational yoga in Rishikesh, published maybe in 2004.
Yes.
I think I'm getting that name correctly. And then you had Joe Alter's book and Elizabeth de Michaelis, and those were kind of all around 2004, 2005. And I
yes,
feel like...
I think Joseph Alter, some of his articles had come out before then. But one of the great frustrations that I do remember when starting to learn and practice yoga was the lack of solid work on its history. So I would often have questions about a style of yoga, where it came from, why it was so different to other styles. And it was in many cases very difficult to find a secular look at the history. So a lot of the publications back then were very much filled with the myths and the folklores of yoga, which was fine, very interesting. But I think it's also important to understand some of the historical events behind those myths and folklores. And that was not so readily available when I started practicing, and it was a motivating factor, I suppose, for my continuing study of the academic side of yoga.
Yeah. So how did that continue to develop after your BA, and you then had these experiences training in Hindi and Sanskrit, and you were sort of being exposed to the fields, and you were also furthering your own yoga practice at the same time? How did this then develop into you pursuing further graduate studies and you ending up at Oxford for the DPhil?
Well, after my BA, I did an honours thesis with an honours year with Dr. Peter Oldmeadow. And my proposal for that year of extra research was to do a translation and study of a text called the Amanaskar. This text had been suggested to me by David White. I'd read his book, Alchemical Body. At the time, that book was perhaps one of the few comprehensive studies of the history of yoga and in that case, alchemy.
Mm-hmm.
And I could see from that work that there was an enormous amount of textual material that hadn't really been studied. So I contacted David, asked for his advice, and he suggested a text called the Amanaskar.
Mm.
I obtained a copy of it, a printed edition that was difficult to get hold of, but there was a couple of copies in Australia. And I started to study that text, and it was a printed edition, I think published first in the 1960s. And it was in terrible condition. There were many problems with the text, many ungrammatical verses, and a lot of it didn't make sense just from that perspective alone. So I reached a point where I sort of had to discuss with Peter whether to continue with the work, because my initial proposal was just to translate it and study its content.
Mm-hmm.
And he suggested that I talk to a scholar who had done a lot of work collecting manuscripts in India on Jainism. He was studying at the Australian National University. His name was Dr. Royce Wiles.
Mm.
And he suggested to me that in the situation I face, that I should have a look at some manuscripts to see whether they help elucidate some of the problems with the printed edition. And he gave me a lot of advice on how to go about doing that, the catalogues that I needed to read, the places in India I needed to visit. And so I think it was 2004, I set out on a manuscript hunting expedition, you might say, for 3 months. I planned to visit 6 libraries, 3 in South India, 3 in North India. And I managed to get, I think, 3 manuscripts, perhaps 4, 3 or 4 manuscripts of the Amanuskar. My success was impeded to a large extent because the very first library I visited was the Asiatic Society of Bengal in Calcutta, which is actually one of the hardest libraries to deal with.
Yeah, I've heard that.
Yes, and I was completely unaware of this and naive about how to deal with librarians. And in many instances, I was there for 6 weeks actually trying to get the material I wanted, because for some reason I thought that I would always get it. I was entitled to it, that I was, you know, just going to any library and it was just a matter of asking for the material and that I would eventually get it. And in many respects, the obstacles that were and the delays that occurred at the time, I couldn't believe them. It was sort of like a comedy sketch at times taking place. And
I know the episode.
Yes. I mean, if you had a camera at the time, and this is not just the case with the Asiatic Society of Bengal, if you could sort of do a series of skits, real life skits, if you were able to capture the moments at various libraries and put them together. But I suppose at the time I wasn't expecting it, so it was all very fresh and so I had much more tolerance for it and was able to persevere. Whereas if it happens now, I must say, I get quite angry and funnily enough, I don't have the tolerance for it and I end up usually leaving if I think that it's going to be too difficult.
Well, you're very seasoned now and you know what you're looking for.
Well, in that respect, it hasn't helped because, you know, my ability to deal with librarians and to sort of remain calm and negotiate in a sort of a measured way has actually deteriorated. If it's not going well, I mean, in many respects, I must say going to an Indian library can be a wonderful experience. So I've had instances where the librarian has taken me on a personal tour of the library, showed me their most valuable material and provided me with copies of manuscripts free of charge, with plenty of cups of tea and stimulating discussions about Sanskrit and the history of India. So I must say, in some respects, you can walk away from a library completely uplifted and inspired by the experience. And then in other cases, it's absolutely devastating, particularly when you go to a library that you know has very important material, perhaps an old manuscript of the text that you might be working on. And if you can't get a copy of it or perhaps even see it, at the time it feels like you're being deprived of the opportunity to do good work, of the opportunity to do what needs to be done.
Jason, just for our listeners who are maybe just a little less familiar with this process and what you're describing, I mean, tell us a little bit about, you know, these libraries and archives, you know, holding these manuscripts, And what are some of these challenges? Why are you having trouble accessing manuscripts at these libraries? Why can't you simply, as you said, just show up and you've got your scholarly credentials? Here's the listing in the catalog. Why can't you just retrieve the manuscript, make a copy of it, and carry on with your work?
Yes, I must say it's very unpredictable how things will go at a library. There are state-run libraries. Some of them are very large. They have collections of over 50,000 manuscripts and many people working at the library, and there's quite a hierarchy from the person who goes into the archives and fetches the material to the librarian and then the director of the library. Some of these larger institutions have a board of directors or a committee that one also needs to deal with. And in some cases, you actually need to deal with a local politician to get permission to copy something. So sometimes walking into a small library can be a very different experience to walking into a large institution. It may be that the librarian is the only person working in the library, and I sometimes get the feeling that they haven't seen someone for a long time. And so often in that case, it can be a very good experience. You sort of, the librarian's willing to talk, find out what you're doing and how he or she can help. In other libraries, it can depend very much on the work culture. In many cases, the requests that a scholar makes to a librarian may just be extra work. It can be difficult to find material in the archives. There's often a lot of rules and regulations to follow, particularly if the scholar's requesting copies, a lot of paperwork to fill out. So I sometimes think when a librarian is not very helpful, not very enthusiastic, that it's simply because they're not wanting to do that extra work that they mm-hmm. would otherwise not have to do.
Yeah. Do you think, I mean, are there other, maybe even, not to get too into the political matters of this, but, you know, is there sometimes skepticism or mistrust of a non-Indian scholar coming into one of these institutes? Credentials, and is there a mistrust of what a scholar is perhaps going to do with some of these materials?
Yes, sometimes there is a paranoia that a foreign scholar will take the material, and I've had this said to me by some librarians, take the material, go overseas, publish it, make an enormous amount of money, and the precious thing that they think they're guarding will no longer be of any value.
Mm-hmm.
I've had some librarians express that. But I must say, on the whole, Indian scholars often struggle as much as foreign scholars in accessing this material. And that's something I've been surprised at over the years, particularly working with pundits at the EFEO. Right. They've often gone to the same libraries that I have in South India. And in some cases, they have even greater difficulties. I remember one case where I visited a library with a research assistant who was accompanying me, but we went into the library separately because this particular library had a limit on the amount of manuscripts that a person could copy. Mm. So we thought if the librarian thought we were connected, they might limit the number of manuscripts we could copy to the minimum. Whereas if we went in separately, then both of us would get the minimum amount.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember that he went early in the morning. He went actually to the temple beforehand, was dressed up immaculately in his dhoti and his hair combed and so forth. And he went in planning to make, I think, quite an impression. And it just so happened that the librarian was Muslim, and when she saw him all dressed up, been to the temple and so forth, he had a lot of trouble dealing with her. She was not particularly wanting to help him, and he went in before me, And I remember he came out almost in tears, saying, "Oh, I don't think she's going to help at all. I tried. She even made me read some of the manuscripts to prove I could read Sanskrit, and she just he seemed very unhelpful." And then I went in, and I didn't have to read any of the manuscripts. I fortunately had the right paperwork. She was very strict about the rules. I could only copy, I think, two manuscripts, which was part of the problem we were facing. We wanted copies of 20 or 30 manuscripts. But nonetheless, she was reasonably polite. So, you know, that indicated to me that, again, it's very unpredictable. It could have been the other way around.
Sure.
But, yes, often Indian scholars face tremendous difficulties. And also funding can be difficult, you know, to go to the other side of India to pay for accommodation, particularly if the library is slow, you have to spend a week or two there to get the material.
Yeah.
It's it requires funding.
Well, it's a real tragedy in many cases. I mean, I think we do want to be sensitive to and understand that there are, you know, histories of colonialism that are at play in some of this. And, you know, I think there's perhaps some good deal of skepticism, you know, perhaps stemming from that. You know, it is true that, you know, Indian culture and texts and sculptures and you name it have been poached and, you know, have, you know, been exported and are now found in museums in London and around the world. And I think there's, you know, a good reason to want to hold on, you know, you could say, to those sort of cultural treasures. But at the same time, now it's to such an extent that these manuscripts that are just sitting there rotting and then not being opened up to anyone, you know, whether, you know, foreign or Indian scholar, as you're sharing in some cases, that doesn't serve anybody. And it's really quite unfortunate that, you know, some of these texts now that could actually really contribute to our understanding in this case for us of the history and development of yoga. But think about what these manuscripts and archives are holding, so much more vast treasures of history, philosophy, literature, and culture. What a waste to just have those be sitting there, right?
That's right. And I might add that, funnily enough, the libraries that are often the most difficult to deal with in the sense that they just don't want to let scholars see their work or give copies of manuscripts are often the libraries that are doing the worst job in looking after their collections.
Mm.
They're often the libraries where you request to see manuscripts and they can't find them. Now, whether that's because they've been misplaced, or, you know, perhaps the greater fear is that they may well have disappeared, or whether it's the fact that the manuscript, as you say, might be rotting on the shelf.
Mm-hmm.
It's often the libraries that are the least helpful that have these problems. And I have indeed gone to libraries, seen a manuscript, say in 2004 or 2008, when I was there, it was in terrible condition. And then I've gone back at a later time to request it and they can't find it, or you get the feeling that because it was in a terrible condition that it's perhaps since perished and they've thrown away. So material is being lost. There is some urgency in the type of work that we're doing, particularly in an area where it's, you know, essential to look at the manuscript material, where texts haven't been edited in the past. There are not necessarily printed editions of the material we want to work on. So there is urgency. That the tradition of copying manuscripts has pretty much died out in India. Mm. So a manuscript, particularly in the more tropical parts of India, may last 100 or 200 years before it deteriorates. There's also the risk of it being eaten by worms and insects. And in the past, when that was happening, the manuscript would usually be copied by a scribe. And there would have been an industry of scribes who were performing that task. And that's not being done today. I think the main effort to preserve this amazing archive of India's history, the main efforts that are going on today are to photograph or digitize the manuscripts. And I must say, in many Indian libraries, that is taking place. And sometimes they're using very good technology. So the scans can be very good, and the archive well organized. And that's heartening. It's also very heartening when working with librarians and pundits who clearly understand the situation, understand the importance of the material that it's decaying and needs to be preserved, and are doing a tremendous effort in conservation and the study of the material as well.
Yes. So maybe we can circle back to this when we get later in this conversation to your work on the Hatha Vyasa Padati and its manuscript history and situation. But I'm afraid I let us get a little sidetracked. I wanted to get back to your fascinating and important work on the Amanuska, which started as your MA project, but then also became your DPhil thesis at Oxford, where you worked under Professor Alexis Sanderson. So how did that project develop? And tell us, you know, a little bit more about this text, the Amanuska, and how this, you know, once you found these manuscripts, how did that develop into a fuller project? And how did these manuscripts, you know, tell a fuller picture of this text?
Yeah, so I ended up doing a critical edition based on 3 or 4 manuscripts for my honours thesis. And I remember at the time I submitted that, or it may have been shortly afterwards, that James Mallinson published his book on the Khichdi Vidya, or perhaps I saw his thesis. He finished his thesis earlier. I found a copy of his thesis on the internet. And I realized that the sort of format that he used and the extent of the manuscript material, his collating technique of collating and editing and so forth, was exactly what I wanted to do, or what I needed to do to do a good edition and annotated translation of the Amanuska. So I immediately got in touch with him. We had correspondence for many years. I think this started in 2006 or 2007. And he, at one point, I mean, he saw the work I was doing, and at one point he suggested that I apply to study with Alexis Sanderson, because he said Alexis has supervised many critical editions, and if I wanted to do a doctorate, he was probably the best person that I could study with. So I made the application. I felt I had no chance, because for an Australian studying in Oxford, the fees were astronomical as a foreign student. I think they were £90,000 for 3 years or so.
Yeah, I remember looking at that and facing that same obstacle as a US student considering applying. And
yes, well, this was 2008. So now it would be much higher, because they've had I think the fees have been revised since that time. So it would be even more expensive now.
And limited scholarship opportunities for foreign students.
That's right. There are very limited scholarship opportunities. I was fortunate enough to win the Clarendon Fund. And I realize now again that I was, you know, my application and the fact that I was applying to Oxford at that time, it was just very fortuitous that what I proposed to do was exactly the sort of work that I think Alexis was willing to supervise. I was looking at a Shaiva text. Mm-hmm. It had interesting connections with an early Jain scholar, Hemachandra, which meant that it was composed at a fairly early time for this genre, before the 12th century. He realized I was looking at the manuscripts and that there was a lot more manuscript material in the catalogs that I should look at. And I think he also saw, because I sent Alexis my thesis, he could also see that the text itself had a lot of connections with earlier Shaiva traditions that I would obviously flesh out and investigate when doing my doctorate. So he obviously supported my application, and fortunately the funding body, the Clarendon Fund, saw the potential of it as well. And the other great benefit I had studying at Oxford was that James Mallinson was there as well, and there were many other scholars working in Shaivism who were able to help me not only with the history but also with the critical editing, the software that was best to use for it, and so I couldn't, in hindsight, I couldn't really have gone to a better place to do the research, and it set me on the path. It was basically a lot of the collaborative work that Jim and myself did during that time that made it clear to us by the time I finished my doctorate that there was an enormous amount of further work that could be done and that we could do if we had further funding. So that resulted in an application to the AHRC, the Arts and Humanities Research Council of Australia, of the UK, sorry. And that resulted in an application where we proposed to edit and translate 10 texts. It got very good reviews, but the AHRC said it was not urgent enough to fund at that time, so we missed out on the funding. But that became the kernel of the application that was made to the European Research Council that resulted in the Hatha Yoga project. So that was the, I suppose, the progression from...
Now, before we get into the texts and the research you've been doing for this Hatha Yoga project, I want to talk to you a little bit about Raja Yoga before we shift to Hatha Yoga explicitly, because I think, one of the unique contributions of your work and this text, the Amanuska that you worked on for your DPhil, is fleshing out our understanding even of this phrase, Raja Yoga, and what it has referred to historically. So today, of course, when most, yoga practitioners or yoga teachers talk about Raja Yoga, they typically, understand that term as relating to the teachings of Patanjali and the Yoga Sutra. But as your work and others has borne out, historically, this is not necessarily the case, right? So what does Raja Yoga mean in pre-modern texts? And do you consider the Amanuska to be a Raja Yoga text? And kind of why or why not?
Well, the Amanuska calls its yoga Raja Yoga. So it's quite explicit in that regard. It is Raja Yoga. It states that at the beginning of the text. And it defines Raja Yoga as the king of all yogas. Now, the Amanuska is a little bit different to the subsequent works. I mean, I think it is the earliest work that we have on Raja Yoga. It dates to probably the 11th century, maybe the early 12th century. And it teaches Raja Yoga as really a type of yoga that can be practiced by anyone. It's fairly sort of simple, easy practice, a sukhopaya, an easy method. And it's completely autonomous in the sense that it does not require any auxiliary practice, even though at the beginning of the text, Vamadeva, who's asking Shiva for the teachings on Raja Yoga, begins by saying, well, I've learnt a preliminary yoga and now I want to know the advanced yoga. Can you please teach me? And then Shiva says, well, yes, I'll teach you the advanced yoga. It's called Raja Yoga. It's the king of all yogas. And it's the yoga that enables the practitioner to attain the self, or to sort of understand the self, which is often referred to as the king of all beings. So it's playing on that type of metaphor that goes back to the Upanishads, some of the early Upanishads.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a distinct type of yoga. It's very much focused on the practice of samadhi. And so amanaskar, the term amanaskar, means no mind state. And amanaskar, unmani, samadhi, the various terms that are used for this meditative state are very much consistent with Patanjali's definition of yoga. Chittavritti nirodha, yoga is a cessation of mental activity. So Raja Yoga itself, the term, was often used to denote this meditative state.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps one of the distinctions between Patanjali and this Shaiva form of Raja Yoga was that there's a strong emphasis on absence of mental activity, but also a strong emphasis on the cessation of breathing. So the meditative state is often described as being free of mental activity, but also at some point the yogi's breath stops, or perhaps becomes imperceptible, disappears, is often the best way to understand the dialogue.
So you think there are some, at least conceptual, overlaps with Patanjali in the Yoga Sutra and his goal of chittavritti nirodha as samadhi, and that you do see some continuity in that formulation of yoga as samadhi and this sort of cessation of mental activity with a text like the Amanaska promoting this sukhopaya, so-called easy path, which I want to come back to, as a practice that leads one to a very similar type of samadhi. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. In so far as both systems, the Patanjali yoga system and later traditions of Raja Yoga, they both emphasize samadhi. Samadhi is the necessary mechanism for achieving liberation. If the yogi does not achieve samadhi, then he or she does not succeed in that regard. The traditions are very different in other ways. In Raja Yoga, there's really only one type of samadhi, and it's, you might say, the highest level, where there's no thinking, no breathing, no physical movement. In Patanjali, we get two types of samadhi: samprajnata samadhi, asamprajnata, and samprajnata, this lower type, which seems to depend on an object of meditation, has four different types. Of course, with Patanjali, there's a lot of sophistication around the philosophy, particularly the Sankhya metaphysics and so forth, that's built in into its discourse. Of course, all of that is absent. And in fact, with the Shaiva traditions of Raja Yoga, there's an antagonism towards philosophy, towards taraka, reasoning, and so forth. They say these are paths that lead to confusion, and that all one needs to do is practice yoga. And you can read thousands of shastras, thousands of scriptures, and you won't get anywhere unless you do the practice, unless you actually achieve samadhi. So in those respects, I think the traditions are quite different, as well as, particularly with the Amanaskar, the method for achieving samadhi is very different. Of course, in Patanjali Yoga, there's the Ashtanga system with the eight auxiliaries, and also the Kriya Yoga with its simpler threefold approach. And the Amanaskar is quite derogatory, if that's the right word, towards such graduated systems. It basically says all the auxiliaries are a waste of time. Ashtanga, Sharanga Yoga doesn't work. All you need is to practice its method, which is Shambhavi Mudra. This is a sort of a a meditation technique that requires that the eyes be kept half open, half closed, and very still. So one's gazing outwards, but the focal point of meditation is within. The practitioner is supposed to sit in an easy posture, sukhasana, and allows the mind to wander wherever it wants to go. And as long as Shambhavi mudra is maintained, then eventually the mind comes to rest and samadhi ensues. So the Amanaskar
sounds very easy, very straightforward.
I suppose it is, but I get the feeling that one was supposed to do it intensively for however long it took for the state of samadhi to ensue. And so if you're going to do it for long hours, day in and day out, then it's perhaps not so easy. But at least conceptually, it's very easy. There's no need to study. There's no need to learn difficult, complex techniques.
And so you mentioned that the text is critical of these progressive, limbed systems. I know there's a couple of verses that directly criticize the practice of pranayama and mudras, which seems to perhaps be a jab at, what we would call hatha yoga, even if it wasn't necessarily by name.
Yeah, it's very, very critical of physical techniques.
What do you think now, given, your reading of all of these texts, what do you attribute some of that to? What do you think is going on in the background for an author of the Amanaska? Do you think that there was these debates that were happening about the most efficacious types of yoga? Lift the curtains a little bit for us of what might be behind that kind of criticism.
Yes, there definitely were such debates, and the Amanaskar was on the side that that an easy method, a sukkopaya, and perhaps a more Gnostic approach not so much in the study of scriptures, but the fact that one could achieve a samadhi that would then bring about a realization of the highest level of reality. That's what the text calls the paramatattva. So in many Shaiva systems, there is a graduated what's often referred to as a graduated ontology, a world view where there are many different levels of reality that start with the gross elements and lead up to the most transcendent and subtle reality levels. And the Amanaskar claims that the highest level can be reached, the highest level of understanding can be reached simply through its practice of Shambhavi mudra. So it certainly favors what we might call the non-action side of soteriology, of the quest for liberation, as opposed to the traditions that favor a more action-orientated approach, which of course is Patanjali yoga. If one's going to do asana, pranayama, follow the yama, niyama, and so forth, as well as the physical styles of yoga, or even if it's the recitation of mantras, these are more, or the performance of ritual. These are the sort of more action-orientated approaches, and the Amanaskar is particularly critical of all of them, whether it's ritual, mantras, or whatever. Basically says that one is wasting one's time in pursuing them, that it's unnecessary exertion. And of course, Hatha Yoga falls very much within that domain. Mm-hmm. So it foregrounds Raja Yoga. There's really no discussion of any other type of yoga. Raja Yoga is all one needs to do. And most of the text consists of verses just describing the meditative state, which makes it quite interesting. There are some references to physiology at times, the breath for stopping body heat and so forth. But also there's a a long sequence of attainments that actually takes place over the course of, I think, 24 years. So it's quite fascinating on that level. But in terms of practice, actually doing something and a system of practice, it doesn't elaborate on that whatsoever. It just basically says that that side of yoga is unnecessary.
Yeah, and I think then when you get to the Hatha Pradipika, you know, Svatmarama's text, perhaps at the beginning of the 15th century, so maybe a couple hundred years after the Amanaska, seems like, you know, at least in my reading, Svatmarama seems to be responding a bit to some of those critics, perhaps like the author of the Amanaska, those who want to see Hatha Yoga as unnecessary, even dangerous or superfluous, you know, to Raja Yoga. He wants to, right at the beginning of the text, say, Hatha Yoga is the stairwell that leads to Raja Yoga. And at many points throughout the text, and it, perhaps even the entire text as a whole, kind of making this case for Hatha Yoga, but showing how it's inseparable from these higher goals of Raja Yoga and Samadhi. Do you agree with that, that Svatmarama is responding in some ways to these critics of Hatha Yoga?
Absolutely. I think he's following in the tradition of the four yogas that we start to see shortly after the Amanaska, where from perhaps the 12th century onwards, Raja Yoga is part of a hierarchy of four yogas. It's the highest, the best yoga. And the other three, which is Mantra, Laya, and Hatha Yoga, are the means for achieving Raja Yoga. So this system, perhaps the earliest exposition, is in a text called the Amaraoga, one of the texts that we're editing and translating for the project. And it's a text I've written an article on for the Journal of Indian Philosophy. We've found an earlier recension of the work, which has enabled us to see that it is such an early, you might say, rudimentary work on Hatha and Raja Yoga. And there it's quite clear that Hatha Yoga is a means for attaining Raja Yoga. And I think it's this fourfold system is perhaps based on four different types of students. So the idea is that the very capable student will perhaps go, you know, you might say the exceptional student will be able to undertake the practice of Raja Yoga without practicing Mantra, Laya, or Hatha. Mm. But for the students who are less capable, who are not able to just sort of sit in Samadhi, then they have to practice one of the other yogas. The least capable practice Mantra Yoga, the slightly more capable Laya, and then the you know, the more capable again practice Hatha Yoga.
That reminds me of the Patanjali Yoga Shastra. Actually, there's this lovely little comment at the beginning of the Bhashya, of the commentary on the second pada, on the sadhana pada, after the first pada on samadhi, on meditative absorption. The second pada on practice then begins, and it says, you know, everything before this first pada on samadhi, that was for those whose minds basically are already in samadhi. But for everybody who's vyutana, whose chittas are more agitated, filled with chitta vrittis, now we're going to lay out kriya yoga and then ashtanga yoga. So these physical practices, these are for those students who need it, right?
Yes, and I think the idea of there being four types of student goes back to that time as well. It's mentioned in the Patanjali Yoga Shastra. I think it's in the Bhagavad Gita as well. And it seems it continued through. Of course, it's in the Amrita Siddhi, which as we now know, is a Buddhist tantra that was a source text for the Amaraoga. And there we have four types of student. They're very similar to the same expositions of the four types of student in the Shiva Samhita and a later version of the Amaraoga called the Amaraoga Prabodha. And so there it's explicitly said that the, you know, four types of student correlate with these four types of yoga. So I find the relationship interesting because, you know, if we think of the past debates on, you know, that we see in the Amanaskar and earlier Shaiva traditions about easy and difficult techniques, here we're seeing, you know, more action-orientated yogas being united in a sense, or brought together with Raja Yoga, this yoga of complete inactivity, complete stillness, in a way that seems to cater for students who want to go straight into Raja Yoga, who have that desire and capability, and then other students who perhaps want to practice mantras or the simple meditation techniques of Laya Yoga or the physical practices of Hatha Yoga, being able to pursue that path and reaching the same goal. Yeah. And as you mentioned earlier, this of course changes in the Hatha Pradipika. There the relationship is redefined, mantra and Laya Yoga drop out, and it's basically a twofold system where Hatha Yoga is the sole means to Raja Yoga. It's the sort of one size fits all approach. Everybody, it seems, has to do Hatha Yoga. If there's no Hatha Yoga, there's no Raja Yoga, as Svatmarama says. If there's no Raja Yoga, there's, you know, Hatha Yoga is pointless.
Right.
And so the two yogas are bound together. But I might just add that in every text after the Amanaskar, Raja Yoga is always taught with Hatha Yoga. The two become almost inseparable in that degree. We do get, I think, maybe one or two Hatha Yoga texts that fail to mention Raja Yoga, but in just about all cases, Hatha and Raja Yoga go together. And in the Hatha Pradipika itself, the largest, or perhaps, you know, one of the largest chapters, the fourth chapter, is entirely on Raja Yoga.
That's interesting. So when people talk about a Raja Yoga tradition, is that something historically that we can really speak about?
Well, certainly from a textual point of view, if we're looking at a corpus of literature that you know, expounds upon this type of yoga over the centuries and is sort of self-referential in many respects, the Hatha Pradipika being a classic example of that, it takes many verses from texts like the Amaralga and the Amanaskar to formulate its teachings and in many respects redefine those teachings. And this is the case throughout the centuries. I think authors are looking back at the earlier texts, taking material and recycling it, repurposing it, refashioning it. And I have a feeling that that was happening on the ground as well, that practitioners would be referring to texts, or perhaps the guru who would then pass on the teachings orally to students. So in this respect, we see continuity over the centuries. And of course, we also see that authors used the teachings of past texts to sanction their innovations as well. Mm. So it may be that you know, new techniques, new physical practices that were becoming popular in India at a particular time suddenly are incorporated into Hatha Yoga as, say, the Shatkarma, as these sort of six therapeutic interventions that could assist a yogin who's suffering from excessive phlegm or fat, who couldn't necessarily perform pranayama as a beginner, then could perform these six preliminary practices, and suddenly that's part of Hatha Yoga that then other authors pick up on and incorporate into their texts. Also, of course, as you would know, many of the complex postures that were absorbed into yoga over the centuries were absorbed under the auxiliary of asana, whether it was an Ashtanga system or the fourfold system of the Hatha Pradipika. It seems that you know, the fact that some early works mention 84 asanas, the Viveka Martanda, the 12th century Viveka Martanda, the Dattatreya Yoga Shastra being two notable examples, then enabled later authors to incorporate many more postures, even though those early texts seem to suggest that the authors were aware of 84 asanas and then basically say, well, to do hatha yoga, all you need is one or two postures, padmasana and siddhasana, the emphasis of the practice being on pranayama and mudra. Even though that was the case, later authors and commentators can easily overlook that and say, yes, there are 84 asanas. Here's a list of 84. Here's descriptions of 84. And, you know, and then they might expound upon the healing benefits of the postures, as we see in the Yoga Pradipika. Basically for every posture talks about the health benefits, the yogic benefits, such as, you know, raising kundalini or bringing about samadhi.
So Jason, let's back up a little bit. I want to talk more about this development of asana, and particularly, you know, your contributions to our understanding of the history of asana, which I think has been really one of the big gifts that you've given us in your work. So you wrote an article, or a chapter rather, in the edited volume Yoga and Transformations. The chapter is titled "The Proliferation of Asanas in Late Medieval Yoga Texts," and I really want to highlight and lift up this chapter and encourage people to read it, because this is based on years and years of this archival work that you've been doing, bringing forth unpublished manuscripts, and I think it really has pushed forward our understanding of the history and development of yoga postures. And this is a subject, as our listeners will know, that has been, you know, the subject of some controversy and debate, you know, over the years. You know, where do these asanas come from? How many of them are sort of new or were developed in the modern period? How many of them actually kind of can be traced back to these pre-modern yoga traditions? And I think, you know, as you do so well in this article, you really map out what we do know, what we don't know, based on the historical record. And you highlight how the early texts, as we now well know, teach, as you just mentioned, relatively few asanas. But then around the 16th, maybe 17th century, there's a shift in the number of asanas taught in these manuscripts. So tell us a little bit about, you know, the significance of some of these works that you located, and, you know, what we now know about the development of asana and the role of asana and more complex asanas that were being taught during this period.
Yes, well, as you mentioned, I think the dilemma 20 years ago that scholars faced was the discrepancy between the number of postures that were being taught in India in the early 20th century and the number of postures that they saw in yoga texts, the yoga texts being available at the time, the Patanjali Yoga Shastra having three sutras on asana, and then the Shiva Samhita, the Hatha Pradipika, teaching 15. I think the Shiva Samhita teaches 4, and then the Garanda Samhita has been widely available in the 20th century. And that teaches 36 postures, but not many of them are the same as the postures that you know, were taught in the early 20th century. So there was really no way of connecting the dots between the textual sources that were available and the situation that we see in early 20th century India. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, I suppose, partly good fortune. It was just part of my, as you say, my archival work, that I was able to come across manuscripts that that contain lists or longer chapters or descriptions of postural practice. And I must also say that an important pioneer in this area was Dr. Gorotti, who established the Lonavala Yoga Institute, and he worked at the Kaivalya Dharma Yoga Institute before he established his own institution. He did a lot of work in collecting manuscripts, particularly in Maharashtra and Rajasthan, that have more information on asana, postural practice. And he also I did a great service in editing and publishing some of these works. So in many respects, I was able to build on what he had done. I mean, he was, unfortunately, I think he died prematurely, and he would have done a lot more valuable work had he lived longer. I think he passed away in 2004.
Right. And now his son, who's also named Dr. Gorote, now carries on his institute. I had the fortune to go meet him and look at some manuscripts together.
Oh, great.
In Lanavala a few years back.
Well, I hope he is, carrying on the work, because they had, because of his father, they have a wonderful collection of manuscripts, and there's a lot of work that they could continue to do. And I had the good fortune of meeting Dr. Gorote Senior, you might say. Mm-hmm. And, when I met him, I think, which was a year or two before he died, he was very energetic, doing a lot of work. He just published the Hatatattva Kalmudi, a large text on Hatha Yoga. He was working on the Encyclopedia of Asanas, which I've also found immensely valuable.
Yeah.
Although it's somewhat difficult to use. But yes, I think his work's been very, very important. But I suppose what I was able to see, particularly with the help of Jim and my earlier research on the history of Hatha and Raja Yoga, I was also able to see some of the chronological development and the fact that the early texts are almost indifferent towards the practice of asana, even though they do describe Siddhasana or Padmasana as being important. For the practice, you might say they're rather indifferent towards complex asanas, non-seated postures, and how that starts to change after the 15th century, basically after Svatmarama in his Hatha Pradipika incorporates seven non-seated postures. And that, to some extent, seems to open the floodgates. And by the 16th, 17th century, we have texts and compendiums that are expounding on 84 asanas, and then others that, like the Hatha Vyasa Padati, expounding on 112. Mm. And also, starting to document rather sophisticated forms of postural practices. So again, we have scholarly compendiums that basically list and describe asanas like they're discrete phenomenon and not really giving much information about how they were practiced or how they might be put together. Well, I think the Hatha Vyasa Padati is an exception in that regard. Also, at the moment, we're editing the chapter on asana in the Hatha Sanketa Chandrika, which is another large compendium composed by Sundaradeva. He's the author who wrote the Hatatattva Kalmudi that I mentioned a moment ago. Mm-hmm. And this text is unpublished, and it has a very long chapter on asana. And there we find some fascinating details about its practice, not just the complex poses, but also the seated poses. So it's really during this time, the 16th and 17th century, that we start to find longer, more detailed discussions of postural practice, some of them foreshadowing the developments that we see in the late 19th and early 20th century. But unfortunately, a lot of this material has been unpublished. So the scholars 20 years ago who were wondering, what the connection was between modern and pre-modern practice, I think some of their questions are starting to be answered, and we are finding direct connections. We are finding instances where gurus in the early 20th century used texts or collections of asanas, and readapted them for a modern audience, in some cases an international audience.
Fascinating. So one of the important texts that we've mentioned a few times in all of this, and that you're editing along with Mark Singleton for the project, and that's one of our important sources here for the development of more complex systems of asana, is the Hatha Vyasa Padati. So tell us a little bit about this text, why it's unique, its significance, what we've learned about it, you know, over the last few years of this project.
Well, I was fortunate enough to find a manuscript of it in a library in Pune in 2012, and the text had been mentioned in one of Dr. Gorotti's publications, I think his Encyclopedia of Asanas, but he had really used it as a source work and hadn't given any details about its content other than the postures or any systematic analysis, because the postures are scattered throughout his encyclopedia. So I went to the library and I was lucky enough to find it, because it's catalogued under the incorrect name. It's catalogued under the name Asana Bunda, whereas I think the beginning of the text provides a more plausible name for the work, the Hatha Abhyasa Paddhati. Paddhati meaning manual, Abhyasa meaning practice, Hatha in this case, Hatha Yoga. Mm. And I remember at the time returning to Singapore, where Jackie was teaching yoga full-time at a yoga school there, and we went through the practice together, through the section on asanas together. And of course, that particular manuscript, the descriptions are not in the best shape. There's a lot of scribal errors. The descriptions are very terse. At the time, we didn't realize there was illustrations that could be found for these asanas. So we undertook, a period of experimenting with the postures, of practicing them. Jackie in particular was particularly proactive there. She also came up with the idea of teaching workshops that explored the practice of the postures, and that was mm-hmm. really very valuable, because we were able to ask a lot of yoga practitioners and teachers what they thought the postures were like, you know, what the instructions were saying, and different ways of different possibilities.
Yeah, sometimes the phrase embodied philology is being used. I'm not sure, is that something that Jackie actually developed?
Yes. So what she would do when teaching the postural practice of the Hatha Abhyasa Paddhati was basically give a translation of the pose, and then let everyone experiment with that, trying, you know, and so you'd see, you'd look across the room and you'd see people doing all sorts of different things that were sometimes completely unconnected, but of course they're seeing it from a different perspective, and sometimes that was very refreshing for us and offered insight into other possibilities.
Well, and correct me if I'm wrong, but one of the unique aspects of this text is that it does seem to teach asanas in a progressive sequence, and so actually performing the asanas has been quite helpful for you guys in, you know, understanding even how to translate in certain instances, to understand the asanas as a whole, as a set.
Yes, that's something that came later with our continued sort of experimentation and as we gathered more information on the practice, particularly with the discovery of the Sri Tapaniti and its illustrated folios that were published by Norman Seuerman in his tremendously valuable book, The Yoga Traditions of the Mysore Palace. And there we were able to see that it was the practice of the Hatha Abhyasa Paddhati, the postural practice, but all jumbled up. The asanas were in a different sequence. And so the Hatha Abhyasa Paddhati gave us insight into the correct order of the postures, and it's easy to see that there is a correct order, because often one posture will begin with the name of the previous posture. Mm-hmm. In the beginning, I thought this could be just a literary mechanism that the author, in order to save space, and we see this in the Hatha Pradipika actually with the description of Kukutasana, mm-hmm. Svatmarama says, start in Padmasana, mm-hmm. you know, adopt the position of Padmasana, and then explains to the practitioner what to do with the arms and legs. So by describing Padmasana before Kukutasana, the author is able to provide a very succinct definition of the later pose. And to some extent, we thought, well, in the beginning, we thought this was happening in the Hatha Vyasa Padati. But then there were slowly over time, I suppose, clues that this that there was more happening with this sort of textual description. In many cases, or in some cases, the previous pose didn't really resemble the shape of the following pose. So if you were using this as a literary mechanism, you would really only do it in cases where the previous pose helps you to describe the following pose. And there are instances where the previous pose is a completely different shape, and yet the next pose starts with the name of that posture. We also saw that because the descriptions are so terse, in some cases it was only possible to understand a posture by knowing the previous shape. And again, this is something that unfolded with the, I suppose, the practical investigations that Jackie and myself undertook with the help of other practitioners, that, you know, often when going from one pose to another, people would say, oh, well, it, you know, or Jackie would often realize herself that actually what you need to do is simply remain in the previous pose and simply move an arm or leg. Mm-hmm. Very simply to achieve the next pose. So then through this process, it's become much clearer to us that the Hatha Vyasa Padati is in all likelihood teaching six sequences. I mean, one of the frustrating experiences, I suppose, of working with any yoga text is that we can't speak to the author themselves. Several, maybe in this case 200 years, 300 years separates us. The author doesn't explicitly say that they are sequences. He does allude to it in a later part of the text, but if the emphasis were on sequencing, you would expect it to be in the section on asana. He doesn't use the word krama in that section. He uses asana krama in another section and then points to the first pose of one of the sequences.
And what about the term vinyasa?
Yes, that doesn't occur in the text, but just to finish my previous thought, even though the author doesn't state explicitly that the postures are sequences, I have a feeling that, like many other yoga texts, if it was obvious to the author and obvious to the audience, then he probably felt he never felt the need to. And so in this case, I think he was documenting a sequential practice of asanas. We see it in the descriptions themselves. One posture leads to another. It's often presumed that the practitioner is in the previous posture in order to follow the instructions of the next posture. So in many respects, the instructions are describing transitions. And part of the transitions, and this could well be, it could be an innovation that happened at the time, or again, it could be documenting a practical part of the tradition that just hadn't made it into a text before this time. Part of that transition is what you might call linking postures. So in the section on the supine postures, which is where the yogin lays on his back, as in Shavasana. Shavasana often is the linking posture between many of the postures in that sequence. So I might also say that another reason why we think the postures are sequential is that if they were categories, so in other words, if the category on supine postures were a category, then you would only expect to see supine postures in that category. Well, what we see in each category of the Hatha Vyasa Padati is a tremendous amount of diverse postures. We see inversions in the supine sequence. We see twists, we see back bends, we see tumbles. But the consistent element that sort of gives some indication of why this sequence was called the supine sequence was because the yogin returns to a supine posture in between the complex asanas. So he might do a back bend and then comes down into Shavasana and then might lift the hips up or bend forward or twist in some way and then return to Shavasana.
Similar to how Shivananda teaching sequences are taught, right? Where they'll often have a restful pose in between.
That is an interesting similarity. It could be fortuitous. I think we see perhaps a more direct connection with Krishnamacharya, because we know he had access to basically to both the Hatha Vyasa Padati and the Sri Tapaniti. We know he took an interest in those asanas because there's a set of sketches that his family still has to this day that he was using. And we can also see that some of the postures had an influence on the teachings. I mean, his teachings changed quite considerably over his lifetime. But when he was teaching at the Mysore Palace, of course, this vinyasa method was developed, and we see some aspects of that. Perhaps the idea of linking postures, but also the downward dog pose seems very similar to one of the postures in the Hatha Vyasa Padati called Gajasana, which is a moving asana. So I might also mention that another interesting, or perhaps even unique, feature of the Hatha Vyasa Padati is its emphasis on moving asanas. Many of the asanas are not static. You sort of assume a position and then do a repetitive movement. And Gajasana is a repetitive movement where you're in a downward dog-like position, and then you bend the elbows, take the nose down to the floor, and then lift back up into downward dog.
Right. And so In one of Krishnamacharya's written works, the Yoga Makaranda, he gives this list of some of his textual sources for his formulation of yoga. And one of those is this text that you mentioned, the Sri Tattvanidhi. And so tell us a little bit more. You've mentioned this a few times, but just to illuminate this further, what do you think is the relationship between the Sri Tattvanidhi, which we know was a source text for Krishnamacharya's yoga, and its relationship with this Hatha Vyasa Padati?
Well, I think the relationship is clear, because the Sri Tappanidhi was composed in the mid-19th century, and it's a royal digest. It has all sorts of topics, games that the royal family might play, board games and so forth, through to the types of architecture and deities that they may worship. And it has a chapter on asana, and the asanas are the same, in particularly the textual descriptions, word for word with what we see in the Hatha Vyasa Padati. And as I mentioned earlier, the main difference is that the order of the postures has been lost. We don't exactly know why, but for some reason the Maharaj or the compilers of the Sri Tattvanidhi decided that there were 80 important postures. So he basically extracted 80 asanas.
Not 84.
No, 80, yeah. For some reason, 80. Yeah. Extracted 80 asanas from the Hatha Vyasa Padati, foregrounded those, and the other 20 or 30 come after those. So it's divided between mukhyasanas, these foremost postures, and these anyasanas, these other postures that are described later in the text. And because of this redacting, because of this rewriting, the order of the postures is lost. Yes, and as you mentioned, we know that Krishnamacharya knew about the Sri Tattvanidhi. He had sketches of the postures. And it's quite likely that it influenced his practice. I might also say that, as Norman Seuyman hypothesizes, and as Mark and myself discuss further in a recent article that we've written for the Journal of Yoga Studies, I think it's also very clear that Krishnamacharya was influenced by the Vyayama Deepika. This is a manual on gymnastics, Vyayama being the Sanskrit word for exercise, that was composed in the late 19th century for, according to the author, for the health and well-being of Indian, I'm not sure if he says Indian children or perhaps Indian people, but a lot of the exercises are taken from Indian wrestling. And there's a particular repetitive movement called the joku, which is done between postures, which is very similar to vinyasa. It's very similar in the sense that there's a sort of an up dog type of movement that we don't see so clearly in the Hatha Vyasa Padati. There's Bhujasana or Bhujangasana in the Hatha Vyasa Padati, but it's not connected to Gajasana. But there you have this sort of up dog movement, and then the practitioner then takes the hips back to a downward-like position, a downward dog-like position, but with the knees bent. And that's perhaps where Krishnamacharya was influenced by the Hatha Vyasa Padati, because, downward dog, of course, has the legs straight and the gazing point is the navel. And these are two characteristics, two features of Gajasana in the Hatha Vyasa Padati. So I think it's right to say that Krishnamacharya was a little bit like a bower bird collecting things from all sorts of places. He was influenced by the physical culture of Mysore when he was there in the early 20th century. And he had various textual sources at his disposal. He had teachings, of course, from his own guru. And he put them together to formulate a system of physical practice for the children at the Mysore Palace.
Yeah, and in that way, not so unlike other innovators and Sanskrit authors of yoga texts before him, like Svatmarama or others who were consolidating various texts and traditions and compiling and formulating that within a particular traditional approach, but innovating nonetheless. And that's how these traditions seem to move forward. We're kind of winding down our time here, but I'd really be remiss if I didn't ask you about this other really interesting and suggestive connection between Krishnamacharya's yoga teachings and even lore and the Hatha Vyasa Padati. And that is this possible connection with the so-called yoga kurunta or yoga Kuruntaka, these various names, but this somewhat legendary text that's supposed to be a source text for the Krishnamacharya tradition, and then these connections with the name of the author of the Hatha Vyasa Padati. I know this is a somewhat complex story with different puzzle pieces here, and you and Mark do a fantastic job of laying all of this out in the Journal of Yoga Studies article that you just mentioned and which we'll link to in the show notes. But if you could give us the Cliff Notes version of, what is the latest thinking about this possible connection between the author of the Hatha Vyasa Padati and this so-called Yoga Kurunta of Krishnamacharya?
Yes, well, I think our conclusions are quite speculative, because until we see the Yoga Kurunta, it's very difficult to make concrete judgments and conclusions about it, particularly when one becomes aware of the discrepancies between what people have said about this text, whether it's Krishnamacharya's students, Iyengar, Patabi Joyce, Desikachar, or their students. It's often difficult to some of the claims are contradictory. So it's often difficult to know just exactly what was in that text or what it was like. But, of course, the name Kurunta is very similar to the name Kapala Kuruntika, insofar, I suppose, as the term Kuruntika is the same. Kapala, again, we don't know who Kapala Kuruntika is. He's said to be the author or the source of the teachings in the Hatha Vyasapadati. He's probably a siddha in the lineage of Gorakshanatha, Svatmarama, and so forth, because there is because at the beginning of the Hatha Vyasapadati, he's one of the people among gods who is paid homage to at the beginning of the text. So you get Kapala Kuruntikaya Namaha, along with various other deities and so forth. So he's probably a siddha, a famous teacher of Hatha Yoga, and these teachings were attributed to him. Now, there is also the mention of a Kurunta in the Hatha Pradipika. Mm-hmm. Whether that's the same as Kapala Kurunta is again difficult to speculate on. And so it could well be that Krishnamacharya was aware of saw the Hatha Vyasapadati, saw that it was written by Kapala Kuruntika, and then referred to the text as the Yoga Kurunta. The manuscript that we have is incomplete, mm-hmm. so he may well have had access to a complete manuscript of it, and that may have provided more details. It may have actually had the name Yoga Kurunta. Yes, so there's many speculations that can be made about that.
But because we have no manuscript by that name, it remains a bit speculative, those connections.
Yes, definitely. Yeah.
Yeah, fascinating. Well, this has been a really rich and fascinating conversation, Jason. And as we start to wind things down now here at the end, I'd like to ask you just sort of a more practical question, if you don't mind. And this just thinking about the implications of this research, and perhaps our broader audience of listeners, and for the yoga world, for non-academics, why do you think that this scholarship and all these things we've been talking about, why is the history of yoga important for students and teachers of yoga today?
Well, the history is a tremendous resource. It's a huge resource because it goes back 2,000 years. And one of the extraordinary things about India is that it has so much written material from the past, even though, as I mentioned, some of that material is being lost, or a lot of it is being lost. There's an enormous amount of it in archives that goes back, that preserves texts that were written 2,000 years ago, and they were practicing techniques that people today are practicing. And, of course, when yoga was transmitted to students outside of India, to an international audience, the gurus who were teaching it were often referring to the history. They were using texts like the Yoga Sutra, the Hatha Pradipika. If you look at Shivananda's book on yoga asanas, there's a tremendous amount of folklore in that book that refers to the historical sources or some of the ideas that come out of the texts. The idea that a particular posture like Padmasana is important in the tradition of yoga, or that headstand has various names. We can see that the names that Shivananda cites all go back to earlier texts that he was obviously aware of. So I think the history has always been there with the transmission of teachings. And, of course, as yoga has changed over the past decades, as it's being practiced in different environments by different people with different needs, then that history is often reinterpreted. Again, different parts of the history are emphasized, other parts perhaps ignored. And yes, and so I think that the work we're doing will basically provide more information, more resources for students and teachers to investigate what they themselves may have learnt from, particularly if they're learning what Elizabeth Dee Michaelis has called a transnational yoga, a yoga that's sort of coming more directly from India, such as Ashtanga Vinyasa or Shivananda yoga and so forth. The work we are doing will provide more resources. It will provide access to many of the primary sources so people can read them for themselves. We'll try to provide annotated translations. So that means the translation has additional information that helps to make it comprehensible. And I think, of course, for future research, for future study of yoga, in some ways we're laying the foundation for the next generation of scholars by providing critical editions, by collecting manuscripts, looking at the different versions of a text that have existed over the centuries, the relationship between the texts and so forth. This is something that future scholars and practitioners can read and, you know, formulate their own ideas about and come up, I'm sure, with other avenues of research.
Absolutely. I mean, personally, just take the opportunity to say, you know, this your work has been tremendously inspiring and laying groundwork for my own doctoral research. And I know for many others who are sort of coming up in this field and for the broader yoga community who are just genuinely interested in this broader history and understanding the development of these practices and traditions and where all this comes from. As you are coming to the end of the Hatha Yoga project and you're now working on the critical editions and translations, are you also working on a full-length book and monograph as a part of the output of this project?
Yes, although funnily enough, that book is in a preliminary stage. I'm basically publishing or finalizing and finishing books on each of the texts that I'm working on. So there are six texts that I'm directly involved in, and so that will basically be six small texts, and I think six small books, I might say. And I think I sort of have to work that way along with Jim and Mark, because that's the foundation for for future books that provide a broader history about yoga and delve into related issues. I think we've all really understood how much the history changes as we delve into the manuscripts of a text. We see that the text that everybody thinks was the original text, suddenly we find an earlier recension and we see that it's quite different, significantly different and much earlier than what we thought. So I think we need to in a sense have a solid foundation of critical editions before we then start to write broader books and perhaps more accessible books on the history of yoga that we won't have to rewrite in the near future when we find further manuscript evidence or do further critical editions that show us a very different view of a text. So I think the next step is to edit the Hatha Pradipika. Mm-hmm. We can do that now that we've worked so extensively on the earlier works that Svatmarama used to compile that text. And then after that, there's some very important compendiums that were written from the 16th and 17th century that tell us a lot about yoga in the early modern period, how it was being combined with how physical yoga was being combined with Patanjali yoga, how, you know, particularly Vedantic gurus took a strong interest in yoga, despite the teachings of Shankara and others that sort of say that gnosis, you know, knowledge is really the key to liberation. We find Vedantic teachers who trace their lineage back to Shankara writing huge texts about yoga mm-hmm. in the 16th and 17th century. And I think some of those texts quite, you know, they anticipate some of the teachings that we see in the early 20th century, some of the discourse around yoga, where you'll see someone such as Swami Kuvalayananda talking about, on the one hand, the Upanishads, the Bhagavad Gita, and the Yoga Sutras, and then writing a book on asanas that has lots of postures not mentioned in those texts, but not really citing any textual sources. Well, in a sense, we sort of see that in the 16th and 17th century with these Vedantic teachers, you know, writing extensively about yoga in Patanjali's Yoga Shastra, the Upanishads and so on, and then also writing extensively about physical yoga.
Yeah, the sometimes I call the Vedanticization of yoga that seems to have occurred and had a strong influence on the shaping of modern yoga. And thinkers such as Vivekananda and others. Well, thank you so much, Jason. I know we're very excited to see the fruits of all of this hard labor in the form of the publications of these Sanskrit yoga texts, these critical editions and English translations. I think it will be an incredible boon and service to us all to be able to read these original primary source texts. We really look forward to that. So I wish you well and good health. And thanks so much for coming on.
Yeah, thank you, Seth, for the invitation, for your very astute and kind questions. And I also thank anybody who's made it this far in listening to the podcast.
Well, thank you so much, Jason. We'll be in touch soon, okay?
Yes, thanks. Thanks very much, Seth.
All right. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to the Yogic Studies podcast. If you've enjoyed this conversation and would like to support the show, please consider leaving us a positive review and rating on iTunes. As always, we are grateful for your support. Thanks so much, everyone, and please take care.